Hi, and welcome to the Nat Decants podcast. I'm your wine-soaked host, Natalie McLean. Today's story is entitled, A Marriage Made on the Table. As I drive along a country road through one of northern Germany's ancient forests, my stomach grumbles. Naturally, my mind turns to the questions about food and wine pairing that my readers often email me. What should I drink with Pacific salmon? Try a crisp Riesling, I usually reply. How about Indian curry? Have you thought about a slightly off-dry Riesling to balance the heat of the spices? What goes well with fresh salad greens and a lemon vinaigrette? A citrusy Riesling would be perfect. Herb rub chicken? You can't go wrong with Riesling. Did I mention that Riesling is incredibly versatile? The wine is like foam cuisine, the ethereal essence of flavor. We drink it with some of the foods that are toughest on wine, such as sauerkraut, bratwurst, and Wiener Schnitzel. Maybe the Germans had to invent such a resilient wine just to match their traditional cuisine. Riesling doesn't get clobbered by rich dishes because of its steely acidity, but it also pairs well with delicate dishes because of its low alcohol and subtle flavors. In our modern health-conscious society, more and more people are turning away from the problems plaguing meat production, such as unsanitary and inhumane factories, steroids, animal diseases, and fear of cancer. Instead, we're eating lighter foods like salads, vegetables, and seafood, and we prefer spices and herbs for flavoring rather than butter and salt. All these choices are natural partners for Riesling. The magic ingredient that enables Riesling to be such a Venus chameleon is acidity. I usually avoid using the word acid in my tasting notes because of its unfortunate connotations of drinking battery acid or sucking on lemons. But the natural acidity in Riesling is both harmless and beneficial. It gives the wine lift and refreshment. It's the cool wind that tempers the heat of alcohol. If alcohol in wine is depth, richness, and power, acidity is zest, vitality, and youth. Acidity is that prickling excitement that gets your juices running, your mind wheeling. It stimulates you for conversation without dulling your wits. As I round the last forest bend on the road, I can see the lights of Russell Restaurant glowing in the clearing. I've been dying to visit this bistro for its modern German cuisine that's evolved well past the heavy dishes I mentioned earlier. In fact, this country is now second only to France in its number of Michelin-starred restaurants. Yet because there are very few German restaurants in other countries compared to the number of French and Italian establishments, we're not as familiar with this country's cuisine and wine. As well, many people travel to France and Italy on culinary holidays, but far fewer choose Germany. This evening, I'm looking forward to chatting with Nicholas Weiss, the third generation of his family, to run a winery that was originally founded in 1947 by his grandfather. Before taking over the family business in 1997, Nick studied at Geisenheim, and then apprenticed in California and Champagne. His winery, St. Urbanshof, is named after the patron saint of wine producers, the 3rd century St. Urban, also known as Pope Urban I. Russell Restaurant is run by Nick's sister, Ruth, and her husband, Harold Russell, who are maitre d' and chef, respectively. As I enter the warm, cozy restaurant that smells of simmering sauces, I'm greeted by Nick, a handsome 35-year-old who clearly enjoys a good meal. "Shall we start with a glass of Riesling?" he asks playfully, as we sit down at the table with 2 chilled glasses of St. Urbanshof Cabernet. "It's a peerless aperitif, the only wine to drink in the morning," he adds. "It satisfies your blood sugar without making you drunk." Wine in the morning? Nick is my kind of man. But he's not the first to propose such a civilized start to the day. Thomas Jefferson, who visited Germany in 1775, before going home to pen America's Declaration of Independence, described Rieslings as the best breakfast wines. I'm loving this Riesling, a bewitching bouquet of freesia and lilacs. It's a slender wine, but incredibly flavorful with just 7% alcohol. I comment on this, and Nick agrees. We are happy with each percentage of alcohol that we don't have to put in the bottle. People no longer drink aperitifs and ports in restaurants because they're concerned about calories and the drive home. Ruth and Harold, an attractive couple in their 30s, come out to greet us. "If I don't mind," they say. They'd like to prepare a surprise menu this evening of local game and fish, homemade breads, fresh vegetables and fruit from their garden. I don't mind. Our aperitif Riesling goes beautifully with the first course. Breast of wild duck with poached duck liver, sautéed figs, and a sherry vinegar jelly. Riesling cuts through the fat in the duck and lifts up a heavy dish, Nick says, moistening his lips. The wine works just as well with the savory game birds and braised meats, which are often accompanied by a sweet garnish like jelly, chutney, or berries. Riesling's own sweetness, Nick explains, adds piquancy rather than heaviness, making the wine taste more alive. The natural sugar amplifies the wine's fruity ripeness in the same way that we can taste the raspberry flavor more in a tart than in a fruit flan. Today, sweetness is as much the signature of Riesling as bubbles are of champagne. But it wasn't always that way. Most German wines were dry until the 1950s, when sterile filtration allowed producers to stop fermentation when there was still some residual sugar left and to stabilize the wines at that level. Those sweeter wines appealed to post-World War II generation of Germans who'd been forced to ration sugar for years. After the war, the country had to rebuild its infrastructure from roads to schools to vineyards. Out of necessity, agriculture focused on cheap food and wines that could be produced quickly and in bulk. High-yield grapes were planted for sheer volume. Luxury products had virtually no market at that time. The next cabinet Nick and I drink comes from his famous Ochfener Bockstein vineyard, Ochbock to fans. Another steep, rocky slope with slate that leaves a bluish powder on your fingers. Nick still uses viticultural techniques introduced by the Romans 2,000 years ago, like trellising his vines on single poles rather than on horizontal wires between posts, as is done in other countries. The vine canes are tied to the pole in the shape of a heart, which gives the grapes more exposure to the sun and makes them easier to pick. These leafy hearts look like rows of Irish valentines. Our next wine, the Piers Porter Goldtrocken Riesling Spätlese, is a bit sweeter and dances with our second course, belly of pork with goose liver on noodles with nuts and apple vinegar sauce. Nick starts to talk about sugar and Riesling, a subject that provokes debate and frustration for many vintners here. "We're the only country in the world to put our sweetness front and center on the label," he says. "Chateau Akim doesn't list the grams of sugar on its label. We created our own problems by focusing on that aspect. Describing a wine solely in terms of its sweetness is like describing a woman by just her height or her weight. It doesn't give you a sense of the complete person." To combat the sweet and simple image, the German Wine Institute launched an advertising campaign that showed a balding 30-something man next to his teenage self. The tagline read, "He's not as sweet as he used to be, but neither are we." However, I believe that greatness plays in all styles of wine, and there's no need to downplay sweetness. I use an analogy with actors. Are the only great thespians the ones who take on the big, serious roles? No. Some of the most brilliant actors are those who have deft timing to pull off lighter, comedic roles. Grape juice contains two kinds of sugar, glucose and fructose. The yeast consumes the glucose first because it can quickly metabolize it. The more complex fructose takes longer to digest and is often what remains in the wine after fermentation. It tastes like ultra-ripe, succulent fruit rather than simple sugar. The difference is akin to a fresh, ripe plum and plum-flavored candy. Yeast can never completely ferment all the sugar, even in the driest wines, which gives us the concept of residual sugar. Alcohol and leftover natural sugar are almost always a trade-off. The lower the alcohol, the higher the residual sugar, and vice versa. Residual sugar is expressed in grams per liter of wine. German Rieslings often get an unfair rap for cloying sweetness, even though many dry New World wines actually taste sweeter. Take California Chardonnays, for example. Some of the most popular brands don't have the acidity to balance their residual sugar, ripe fruit, and creamy oak notes. The same applies to high-alcohol wines, which taste sweeter than they really are because alcohol gives us the impression of sweetness, even though it actually has no flavor. So, we talk dry and drink sweet. This reminds me of the lovely self-delusion in buying clothing abroad labeled three sizes smaller than the North American equivalent, even though you're really the same size. With Riesling, sweet can be good, dry can be good, Nick observes, but completely dry Chardonnay sucks. Riesling, with all its complexities, is often overshadowed by the more obvious charms of Chardonnay, the world's most popular white wine. Chardonnay is the pliable good girl of the wine world, adapting to the winemaker's hand and absorbing the barrel's flavor. Oak is the sensory counterpoint in wines that don't have much acidity. Just as many people who eat hot buttered popcorn actually like the taste of butter more than the corn, many of those who love Chardonnay actually love the taste of oak, butter, cream, vanilla, and smoke. It's just mean to put California Chardonnay beside German Riesling in a blind tasting, Nick says. Their robust flavors overwhelm Rieslings. We call them U-boats. For me, the difference between the two wines is in their comparative ranges. Riesling is the quivering wine of potential energy that reminds me of opera diva Sarah Brightman singing pop tunes. She barely pushes her voice, yet what thrills me is knowing that her range stretches far beyond what I hear. Conversely, many Chardonnays remind me of breathy pop stars who have to whisper the high notes. That's why there's been a growing pendulum swing against Chardonnay called ABC, anything but Chardonnay. Of course, not all Chardonnays fall into this stylistic camp. Chablis, unoaked Chardonnay from northern Burgundy, shares Riesling's nervy vivacity. Of course, it's not just the unaffordable benchmark wines that should be considered great, whether it's Riesling, Chablis, or Pinot Noir. As Nick points out, relevance is an aspect of greatness. It's important to have a wine that you like and can make part of your daily life rather than having to save it for special occasions. Entry-level wines are labeled QBA, Qualitassen, Bestimmer, Angebet, meaning quality wine that has enough character to taste like its growing area. The best Rieslings are labeled QMP, Qualitätswein mit Prädikat, meaning a quality wine of special distinction. Like it or not, Germans categorize their finest wines not by vineyard or region, like the French and Italians, but according to the grape's sweetness when picked. So Prädikat wines are predicated on six levels: Cabernet, Spätlese, Auslese, Bärenauslese, Eiswein, and Trockenbäreneislese. The greater the ripeness, the higher the wine is ranked. But remember that this designation only refers to how sweet the grapes were at harvest, not necessarily to how sweet the wine will eventually taste. Vintners can still ferment their grapes to complete dryness. You need to learn your Prädikats to understand German wine the way you'll need to learn your multiplication tables for basic math. Quit moaning, just do it. Cabernet Rieslings, like the delicate dry one Nick and I started with this evening, are made from fully ripened grapes. Cabernet originally referred to the locked cabinets in which the most valuable wines were cellared. These wines go well with light dishes such as sole, trout, sushi, salads, smoked salmon, and mild curries. However, this traditional designation has been affected by climate change. Since 1987, Nick has observed increasingly warmer vintages that have made ripeness levels close in on each other. The time between unripe, ripe, and overripe grapes is now a matter of days rather than weeks. The 2006 vintage was the most compressed ever. All the grapes were picked in 3 weeks instead of the usual six. He no longer prunes as much leaf canopy to expose the grapes to sunlight, and new vine plantings are pushing higher up the slopes to achieve the old temperature balance. Weather patterns are getting more extreme too, with climactic oddities like 10-minute thunderstorms and torrential downpours. The next level up is Spätlese, meaning late harvest. These grapes are picked at least 1 week after the main harvest is finished, so the wines have a hint of sweetness and are more full-bodied than the cabinets. Legend has it that the Spätlese style was created by accident in 1775. Back then, a courier on a fast horse took an annual sample of the grapes to Prince Abbott to get his approval to begin the harvest. But that year, the prince was late in giving his consent. By the time the Spätlese rider returned, the grapes had overripened. So rather than lose both the harvest and their heads, the vintners decided to pick the grapes anyway. To their delight, these sublimely rotten grapes created a new, luscious style of wine that was a hit at court. In subsequent harvests, they experimented with leaving some grapes on the vines for longer and longer periods. Goethe, author of Faust, and a man who surely knew how easy it is to sell one's soul for greatness, was an avid fan of these sweeter styles. In 1814, he wrote in his diary, "The excellence of the wines depends on the site, but also upon the late harvesting." Nick and I are now enjoying our third course of codfish in a potato pumpkin broth with white onions and mushrooms. His Peer Porter Goldfecken Riesling Spätlese goes beautifully with this dish. We also drink this wine with two other courses, pike perch with chin of pork, bacon, mashed potatoes, and chicory with orange cardamom gravy, and then, you didn't think you were done yet, did you? Red mullet with chickpeas, polenta, and beans in a carrot thyme sauce. Our sixth course, sweetbreads on fig couscous, dances with our third wine, Achfener Bachstein Riesling Aschlese, redolent of ripe apricots. Aschlese, German for select, are Rieslings made from selected bunches of late harvest grapes. Often, they've started to overripen, becoming affected with the desirable mold Botrytis cinerea, or noble rot. The mold attacks the grape skins, dehydrates the fruit, and concentrates its sugar and flavor. This natural chemical transformation in the grape gives the final wine a lovely orange-tinged flavor. Germany's most famous dessert wines are touched by Botrytis, as are Bordeaux Sauternes, like Château Yquem and Hungary's Tokaj. "The ugliest grapes give the best juice," Nick says, showing me a bunch he's bought from the grapeyard, from the vineyard. "The leathery, furry berries don't look good enough for horse feed, but he tells me that the fruit will yield five different wines. You don't work toward botrytis, he explains, because it destroys the grape skins and fresh fruit flavors. But we allow it to happen because it expresses yet another facet of Riesling. The bitter botrytis taste finds its balance in the wine's honeyed notes, creating a savory character that works with heavy meat dishes like the one we have next, a nut-encrusted saddle of deer accompanied by dumplings and quince in a pepper gravy. Savory dishes like venison demand mature Rieslings, since the sweet and sour element of the meat or plum or raspberry sauce requires a wine that has the intensity of flavor but isn't obviously sweet. That's why mature Rieslings, with their notes of mushrooms, earth, nuts, and dried fruit, also pair well with hearty meat dishes. It's easier to match a white wine with meat than it is to pair a red wine with fish. When we get to Baron Aschlese, or BA for short, we're into the dessert wines. These are made from individually selected grapes, Baron, that are fully affected by botrytis and are starting to shrivel. Nick's Leinwiener Lachowe Riesling Baron Aschlese pairs well with the Dawson apricots in Aspic with chocolate cream and Tahiti vanilla ice cream. Balancing the wine's luscious texture is less a flavor than a faint tingling sensation I used to get as a child from Liqui-Made powder. Winemakers call it minerality, a trait imparted by slate and other rocks in which the vines grow. It shouldn't be confused with the aroma in mature Riesling called petrol, Plants don't metabolize minerals as they do organic material, so grapes grown near roads, for example, don't produce wines with lead in them despite all the gasoline fumes they're exposed to. However, put white roses in a blue-colored water, and they absorb the color pigments that tinge their petals blue. The minerals in slate also dissolve in water, and that's why we prefer to drink mineral water over filtered water, and beers and whiskeys that come from mountainous regions where their water runs over the rocks. Nevertheless, some people confuse minerality and petrol, despite the fact that most winemakers despise the latter. Others use descriptors such as kerosene, motor oil, or gasoline, and I wondered at first if these nuances were imparted from the country's famous Autobahn. Nick certainly doesn't look happy when I ask him about it. Petrol says oxidation at best, contamination at worst, he observes. Who wants to drink either one? While some drinkers and critics think petrol is a good aroma, many consider it a flaw. The aroma often develops when certain compounds in the wine oxidize, usually the result of a short, hot growing season with too little water. As the grape tries to protect itself against environmental stress, it produces organic compounds that smell like linseed oil. Riesling's ability to age is another aspect of its greatness. The British wine writer Jancis Robinson called them whites for eternity. Riesling's acidity survives on its natural sugar, enabling the wines to live longer than most whites, and even many reds. They can easily age for 5 to 10 years, and the great ones for 25 years or more. Chemically, Riesling's molecules bind together to become longer flanking chains. New ones are created and others destroyed in a gloriously silent battle within every bottle. The result is a long, smooth, open wine. The things that last have greatness. Whether it's a novel that still reads well after 100 years or a wine that drinks well after 30, Nick says. We all want the secret of youth, but the real secret is in how to age well. Despite the brief respite between courses, gasp, we enjoy a small glass of Nick's ice wine. Ice wine is made from grapes of Baron-Ochlaise sweetness that are left on the vine in winter until frozen and picked at 18 degrees Fahrenheit or colder. What little water the grapes still have in them is left on the press, so what's extracted is highly concentrated fruit flavor. Nick's Trockenbeerenauslese, or TBA, means dry berry selection for the individually selected grapes in this wine that have completely shriveled to raisins from botrytis. This wine encases our last course, an exquisite dessert of wine-pouched vineyard peaches and a verbena mousse ice cream. TBA wines are the richest, rarest, sweetest dessert wine of nectared depth. Mentally, I compare this wine with Château Chem, also made from 100% botrytis-affected grapes. But the Sauternes has more alcohol and less acidity than the TBA wines. For the true hedonist who wants to prolong pleasure, TBA is your wine. You don't tire of it quickly, and that's why many people enjoy it with foie gras at the beginning of the meal. It's lighter than the traditional Sauternes, and hence less filling and less inebriating. In fact, through extensive research, I've discovered that the only dishes that clash with Riesling are rare steaks, the wine lacks tannin for the meat's juicy proteins to latch onto, and cotton candy. For Pete's sakes, you're at the fair, so have a beer. Now that dinner's over, Nick and I keep ourselves from falling asleep at the table with a spirited discussion on how the country's wine labels are a metaphor for the German soul. Why should our labels be easy to read when our wine is so hard to make, Nick jokes. Should Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain be condensed to make it more accessible? We Germans love complexity. I can tell. Unlike France's relatively stable Bordeaux classification of 1855, the changes to Germany's predicate system since 1971 would bring a Senate inquiry to its knees. The problem was that the new classifications were both too vague and too generous in awarding top status, and they also didn't replace the existing system, but simply added more layers of confusion. However, Nick makes a good point. Burgundy is even more complex. but wine lovers make an effort to understand it because the wines are so great. Germany deserves that same effort. At least Riesling is labeled with the grape, whereas Burgundy's Pinot Noir isn't. And often, there are many owners of one Burgundian vineyard, whereas German estates tend to be owned by one family. Today, the best Riesling producers agree that a national classification of vineyards is the only way to escape the chaos of the sugar cult. However, they're not waiting for the country's wine laws to change. Many have started to brand name their own wines to guarantee quality, such as Nick's Urban Riesling. The International Riesling Foundation, formed in Washington State in 2007, has proposed an even simpler Riesling taste scale. It designates wines as one of the following: dry, off-dry, medium-dry, medium-sweet, and sweet. The power of such voluntary guidelines is not only that they're easier for consumers to understand, but also that they can be universally applied to Rieslings from many regions and countries. Closer to home, Nick feels that Riesling should be the only wine made in the Moselle. Until 1988, making red wine here was actually illegal, but now the government allows up to 10% of production to be red. He also believes that wine should be made only on the south-facing sites and yields should come down. The poor-quality growers get three times as much wine from a vine as the better-quality ones do. "I have Riesling in my blood," Nick says, smiling. "Every generation reinvents winemaking from the way their parents did it. We just do what our grandfathers did. We're trying to get back to where we were, but it might take another generation or two to do that, or a century."